Number one. Number two. Number one. Number two. Wonder if Hulk Hogan will be having some apple pie this weekend in honor of the Memorial Day holiday. I hope so. This is episode 220 of the Solemn Monster Sounds Off on SCScoops.com. It is Sunday, May 27th, 2012. I am the Solemn Monster. Hope everybody is having a good holiday weekend here stateside. That little ditty you heard there at the beginning is a classic clip from the build-up to the dreaded Yappapai Indian Strap match from the dying days of WCW between Hulk Hogan and Ric Flair, where if you really listen to it, it does sound like he's singing about apple pie. And really, who wouldn't want to sing a song about apple pie? It's the best type of pie out there. If The Rock came up to me and asked me what kind of pie I like, my first pie would be apple pie. Number two would be that other type of pie, but we won't get into that right now. First off, thank you to everyone who tuned in and called into SC Scoops Live with myself and Noah Mark this past Monday night before Raw. We talked about the horrible main event at Over the Limit, Raw's big move to 3 hours. We took your calls. We had a fun time. I'm sure we'll be doing more shows in the future. I will not be available next month after the No Way Out pay-per-view. And, of course, in July, Raw moves to 3 hours beginning at 8 p.m., but we'll figure something out. Also, thanks to all those who sent me feedback on the editorial that I wrote for SCScoops.com this past week concerning Raw's expansion to 3 hours, the reasons for and against such a move. The column also got picked up by 24wrestling.com and has gotten a mostly positive response. It's worth a read if you have not already done so, so please do check that out. We have got a lot of news to cover here on this show. We have got over-the-limit results from the pay-per-view last Sunday. I went 6-for-6 in my predictions. I am so happy right now, which is one of the few things about that pay-per-view that actually made me happy. We'll talk about that. We'll talk about Raw from this past week. Impact Wrestling, which I actually caught most of as well. But before we get to any of that stuff, let's talk about something that happened last night. Last night was UFC 146 on pay-per-view from Las Vegas, Nevada. Big main event, Junior Dos Santos against Frank Mir. It was an all-heavyweight show. So I'm watching this, and right before the main event starts, they show Brock Lesnar in the audience, and they identify him as former UFC heavyweight champion, as well they should. But what makes the whole situation so bizarre is the fact that Brock Lesnar is even there. Brock Lesnar is known for not wanting to travel very much. He doesn't leave his home to do very many things, even when he was with the UFC, as was pointed out in the post-fight press conference by one of the reporters last night, and Dana White made mention of this. It was like pulling teeth to get Brock to even go to a UFC show while he was under contract with them, unless he was actually fighting at one. So Brock being there is significant for a lot of different reasons, because Brock wouldn't just be there for the sake of being there. So that, right away, got a lot of people talking on Twitter, all over the internet, the message boards and all that. Why is Brock Lesnar there? Junior Dos Santos, for those of you who are interested, went on to defeat Frank Mir, or as Brock Lesnar might say, Frank Mir. At the post-fight press conference, Ariel Helwani asked Dana White about Brock Lesnar being there, why he was there, if there was any chance that he could be coming back, possibly, to the UFC. And Dana was a little coy in some of his answers, and pretty straightforward in others, basically insinuating that Brock is there for a reason. Brock is not just there just for the sake of being there. Apparently what happened is Brock had texted Dana White about a week or so ago, a week and a half ago, letting him know that he was planning on being there, and told him to keep it under wraps, don't tell anybody, don't tip anybody off, and Dana White kept his mouth shut, because that's the way he does things. And so, nothing leaked. I guess there were apparently some rumors over the past week that Brock could potentially be interested in talking to UFC about a return, but none of that leaked. I didn't read or see anything about that until Brock showed up last night. And Dana said himself at the post-fight press conference, for which I put the video up on my Facebook page, that he was going to be talking with Brock after the show, which means by now they've already spoken about what, who knows, that hasn't come out yet, and that it is possible that Brock could come back to the UFC. So this is a very interesting situation for a lot of different reasons. Obviously, Brock Lesnar is currently under contract to WWE. He supposedly signed a one-year deal worth many millions of dollars, perhaps as much as $5 million, in a contract that is supposed to culminate in a match at next year's WrestleMania in New Jersey. And whether it'll be Brock Lesnar against The Rock for the championship, as has been rumored, Brock Lesnar and The Undertaker, which is a match that has been rumored for a while, Brock and Stone Cold Steve Austin is a number of different possibilities here, but the bottom line is he has a WWE contract through WrestleMania, at least of next year. And so here's Brock Lesnar showing up at a UFC event. Here's the president of the UFC openly talking about the fact that he and Brock would be speaking in private and that Brock could come back to mixed martial arts. And you think to yourself, this has to be a work. Just has to be. Obviously, WWE is trying to get this whole Brock quit story over. They're trying to get the storyline over. Ultimately, it will build to that SummerSlam match or a match at another pay-per-view against Triple H. It's all part of the story. And part of me still believes that, but based on things I'm reading, based on things I'm hearing, it does sound like where there's smoke, there's fire, and there is more to the story than that. I've heard rumors that perhaps the contract that Brock signed is a non-exclusive deal, which if it is, would just blow my mind, because I don't think I can ever remember. And I don't know the kind of arrangement that Vince has with The Rock. I believe heading into WrestleMania this year, the last year that Rock was around, he was on a handshake deal with Vince McMahon, and as of WrestleMania this year, Rock actually signed a written contract. What that contract looks like, I don't know. But put the Rock situations, his situation aside, I don't know that I have ever heard of a situation where Vince McMahon has signed somebody to a deal that would allow them to either compete with another wrestling organization or a mixed martial arts organization, basically a non-exclusive deal. I just can't fathom the idea of Vince McMahon actually allowing that and going for something like that. So I don't know if that's true. If it is true, it would certainly make sense, because then Brock is free to do whatever the hell he wants to do outside of pro wrestling. I'm sure he must have something in his contract that bars him from, you know, TNA and other wrestling organizations, maybe not UFC. I can't help but wonder this. If I don't want to say that Vince McMahon and Dana White have some sort of agreement, I would find that hard to believe, only because Dana White has been very reluctant to partake in stuff like that before. He you know, the lines between MMA and WWE, he doesn't want to blur those lines. You know, a lot of people get very upset when that happens, and wrestling is fake and MMA is real, and you can't mix the two, because what that ends up doing is it ends up tainting the credibility, so to speak, of MMA. And Dana White doesn't want to get in a situation where people are thinking, well, UFC is in bed with WWE, so now how much of the stuff that we're seeing on UFC is fake and how much of it is real? He doesn't want to do that. So it's possible they have some sort of secret deal here where maybe UFC wants to get a little bit of publicity out of it and WWE benefits because it gets their storyline over as being legit, that Brock really did quit the company and isn't coming back, even though he is. I don't know. It's a very interesting situation. It sounds like there may be genuine interest on Brock's part in coming back. Now, to get over the angle, would they allow him to go back to UFC, let's say, for one fight? You know, a Brock Lesnar-Frank Mir fight on the undercard of a UFC pay-per-view could do big business. You know, maybe WWE was spooked by the Extreme Rules buy rate, and I'm going to get to that a little bit later on in the show today. The Extreme Rules buy rate was an improvement slightly over last year's Extreme Rules, but that's not saying much. Basically, the buy rate was a huge disappointment. You have Brock Lesnar, a man who has been part of some UFC pay-per-views that have done over a million buys, in large part because of him and because of his appeal. He was a big box office attraction. Now he comes back to wrestling and is on a pay-per-view that does, you know, domestically 100-something thousand buys. That's a disappointment. I don't care how you paint it. I don't care how you look at it. That's a big disappointment. So maybe if Brock gets back in bed with UFC and actually fights, even if it's just one fight, if it's a fight they think he can win, it somehow, you know, increases his value and will help his box office at the next WWE pay-per-view he wrestles at. I don't know. You're also running a risk if you do that, because what if Brock fights and he loses? You know, it's bad enough that Brock lost his last one or two fights and didn't look very good. Plus, he lost his first match to John Cena, for Christ's sake, which was dumb. It looks even dumber now. You run a risk. If Brock really is going to fight, and I'm not convinced that he will, but if he does and he loses, you know, what do you really gain from that? If anything, I think you're just screwing yourself. So, very interesting situation to follow. I don't know how it's going to play out. We don't have a lot of information right now. This all just happened last night. It's a weekend. It's a holiday weekend, so there's not a lot out there to go on right now. I guess, you know, over the next couple of days, we'll find out more. If this was something that WWE wasn't aware of, and I just find that impossible to believe, but if it was, you're going to have a lot of very unhappy people right now in Stamford, Connecticut, Vince McMahon chief among them, and who knows how they may react to something like this. So we'll see what happens. I mean, again, this is a company that would not allow CM Punk to escort Chael Sonnen to the ring, to the cage, for his UFC fight. For whatever warped reason Vince McMahon had, he was going to let him, and then he changed his mind because I guess he just didn't want him to be on a UFC show. So the idea that Vince would allow Brock Lesnar to show up on a UFC pay-per-view and talk to Dana White and possibly come back and fight while he's still under contract is just, it's impossible for me to believe, but stranger things have happened. We'll see how this all plays out. The other big story of the week, actually there were several big stories this week, but the other one, there was a bit of an international incident for WWE in Brazil. They had their first show ever in Brazil this week, which was a big deal to them, and unfortunately, things did not go as smoothly, I think, as they would have hoped. It was at a live event in Sao Paulo, Brazil, Thursday night. Chris Jericho denigrating the Brazilian flag during a match against CM Punk. WWE had to issue an apology to the Brazilian government, and they have suspended Chris Jericho for 30 days, which means he is likely going to be off the No Way Out show, unless they make an exception and they allow him to compete at the pay-per-view, which really wouldn't make sense. If he's suspended for 30 days, he should be suspended for 30 days, and I believe he is. So he will be off the show, it seems. During the match, basically what happened is somebody threw a Brazilian flag into the ring. And CM Punk picked it up, and he was showing it off, and everybody was cheering, and everyone was clapping, and they were very happy. And then Chris Jericho got the flag. And what he did was he crumpled it up, threw it down, and he kicked it. And there is video of it up on YouTube, at least there was, before it got taken down. Police officers had the match stopped a little bit later on, so they started wrestling. And then mid-match, they had the match stopped. They gave Jericho the opportunity to either apologize to those in attendance or to go to jail, because desecrating the flag in any way, shape, or form is a very serious offense in Brazil. And you can be incarcerated for it. It's a big deal down there. I think it's a misdemeanor and not a felony, but it's still a crime nonetheless for which you can be jailed. And so Jericho got on the mic. He wisely chose the latter. He apologized, because let's face it, who wants to sit in a Brazilian jail? I mean, the only thing I guess that could be worse is probably a Mexican jail. That probably would be a lot worse, but I don't want to be sitting in jail in Brazil. You know, I went to Costa Rica once, beautiful country. I, you know, wouldn't want to be sitting in a jail down there either. So I don't blame him. Jericho spoke with WWE.com after the fact. He said, "I made a bad judgment call in the course of entertaining the fans. I apologize to the people in the crowd for showing disrespect. It was a bad move. I did it with the fans' entertainment in mind, and I will accept the consequences for that." That's what Jericho said. And when I first heard about this, my inclination was to be skeptical of the suspension, particularly with all the talk of Jericho taking more time off soon to tour with Fozzy. I don't think Jericho was going to be taking a year or two off like he usually does. I think he'll be taking some time off here. He'll come back. He has more time he's going to be taking off, I think, for a tour this fall. So Jericho is going to be spotty. His attendance is going to be spotty going forward. So I just figured, you know, this is a way for them to kind of get him some time off right now for at least a couple of weeks. And I'm not saying the incident was planned or that the authorities were in on it or anything like that. Actually, I was kind of hoping he would have been arrested and then WWE could air these really cheesy segments on Raw like they did when Vader got detained in Kuwait back in 1997, and they could put like a graphic up that says Chris Jericho held hostage, you know, day 38. Sadly, this will not happen. By all accounts, this is all legit. What Jericho did, as I said before, is a serious crime in Brazil, and he's very fortunate he was not jailed, because if it were you or me in his shoes, they probably would lock us up and throw away the key. Okay, but Jericho got off. Question is this, was WWE right to suspend him? They're a public company, probably felt they had no choice but to do so. I get that. And it was also their first time in the country, and it's a black eye for them in their first trip to Brazil to have something like this happen, to have to apologize to the government of the country that you were performing in. That's usually a bad thing. So I understand all of that. So in my view, what you do is you have him issue an apology, you fine him X number of dollars, and you make it very clear that such behavior will not be tolerated going forward. I think that would have been sufficient. Now, some might argue that he's lucky he wasn't fired over this, but this firing and suspension stuff, you know, my take on it is this. You're entitled to one strike with this sort of thing. Jericho doesn't have a track record of causing international incidents or breaking laws overseas or desecrating foreign flags. I mean, he's gotten into trouble every now and then, I think, for drinking and being obnoxious and stuff like that. I think him and Shane Helms once had their mugshots taken. I mean, it's not like he's an innocent angel. But there's nothing on his resume that would indicate that, you know, he has a perpetual history of causing incidents like this on overseas tours and stuff like that. So, you know, there's that. So he fucked up. You know, he fucked up doing something that's been accepted in wrestling for decades. Now it isn't. It's a different world now. He's an old school guy. You punish him and you move on. I don't think he should have been suspended. I especially don't think he should have been fired. Thankfully, he wasn't. Yes, he technically committed a crime in Brazil. Then the cops should have arrested him. But they didn't. That was their decision not to. As far as I'm concerned, at that point, it's a done deal. You punish him and you move on. You don't suspend the guy. It's the same thing with the Fit Finley stuff a couple of years ago when he got fired after signing off on an angle at a house show. Actually, I think it was his idea, where the heels interrupted the singing of the national anthem. You know, there were members of the National Guard, a major WWE sponsor, that happened to be in the audience that night. They did not take too kindly to the angle. They complained. Now, by all accounts, Finley had been an upstanding senior statesman in that company for many years. He worked with young talent. He worked with the Divas. He was well-respected by everybody. For him to have been fired over that is something that I still find completely ridiculous. Especially when most people figured that things would blow over, they'd probably just hire him back 6 months later or a year later. Guess what? He's still working indies. So, like Jericho, Finley is an old school guy. He came up in the business at a time when people wouldn't bat an eye to things like that. It was an acceptable heel tactic. That was his mindset in coming up with the angle that night when he got fired. You want to punish the guy? Fine. He was in charge that night. He should be held responsible. Fine him. Fine him and donate that money to a military charity and make him issue a direct apology to the National Guard. Why is that a fireable offense? How are these guys supposed to know which things that used to be acceptable are no longer acceptable if WWE doesn't tell them? I'm not aware of any courses or any seminars, you know, that WWE has with its talent, other than, you know, about social media. They had a seminar recently teaching everybody how to use Twitter and how to properly use hashtags, because that's important to them. But they don't have courses or seminars to explain things that were once acceptable that are no longer acceptable. Shouldn't the company bear some responsibility for that as well? I mean, look at the Daniel Bryan thing during the Nexus Invasion angle in 2010. He choked out Justin Roberts with his own tie and got fired for it. Now, in that case, they did bring him back 2 months later. So why fire the guy in the first place? Sit him out for a little while without pay. Make it clear that you can't wrap things around people's necks to choke them, and if the guy wants to keep his job, he won't ever do it again. I guarantee you that. There's three factors at play here, as far as I'm concerned. One, the world has changed. Everything now is so much more politically correct than it used to be, it makes me sick. Two, WWE is a publicly traded company. Their IPO was in 1999, so for a nice chunk of the Attitude Era, at least half the Attitude Era, when they were doing a lot of heinous shit back then, they didn't have to answer to anybody for it. Now you've got shareholders and sponsors and Mattel and Viacom. They have to be subservient to a number of different audiences. Three is the proliferation of the internet. This may be the biggest thing of all. It's a much bigger thing now than it was back then. And go back even further when these sorts of angles were commonplace in wrestling and you didn't even have the internet. You'd say the word internet back then to somebody and they'd probably think you were talking about catching flies and mosquitoes on your back porch. Today, it's the age of smartphones and, you know, everybody can record and document everything that happens. I mean, hell, if Hulk Hogan had his way, we'd be recording every move the TNA stars make outside the ring with our phones. Remember that idea? It's the age of TMZ and Twitter and all that kind of stuff. So, stuff that otherwise would never get out or would be limited only to the people who witnessed it in the arena, now all that stuff spreads like a virus within minutes. Go on YouTube. You can still find the video of JBL doing the Nazi goose step at a house show in Germany a couple of years ago. I think he got in trouble for that too, although he didn't get suspended. But this is the world we live in today. You can't just blame WWE for it. As society changes, they have to conform to that. I think that sucks. But that's reality. But I would not have suspended Chris Jericho. Another big story this week was TNA filing a lawsuit against WWE and a former employee by the name of Brian Wittenstein on allegations of contract tampering, specifically existing contracts, civil conspiracy, unfair competition, and violation of the Tennessee Uniform Trade Secrets Act. PW Insider broke the story on Thursday. The suit alleges that Wittenstein, who worked for TNA from 2008 to 2011, provided WWE with inside information on talent contracts from his time working in TNA's talent relations and live events departments. And I'm not sure if TNA fired him or if he quit. I think he claims he quit the company, but he's probably full of shit, is my guess. WWE hired him a couple of months ago to work as an assistant under Michael Hayes and then recently let him go. According to the suit, he was fired after presenting WWE with insider information about TNA. And you'd think TNA would be happy about that, but their beef seems to be that WWE waited until several weeks after Wittenstein was fired to let them know about this. As a result, they claim WWE is now trying to lure talent away from TNA, using that insider information to their advantage. Apparently, all the Ric Flair stories about TNA having heat with him, which they do, but that, you know, they took him off TV and they took him off house shows because of his behavior, had nothing to do with that. It appears that Flair, who may have heard from people in WWE, I mean, hell, they just put him in their Hall of Fame again. I'm sure he stays in contact with Triple H and other people who work there. But the belief is that Flair has been in touch with WWE people in some way, shape, or form, and that Flair approached TNA about getting out of his contract and may have no-showed those recent house shows on his own. It wasn't a situation where TNA pulled him from those shows because he was acting, you know, irresponsibly at bars and all of this different stuff. I'm sure that really did happen, but that may have been Flair no-showing, trying to get out of his contract so he can hightail it back to WWE. TNA figures that Flair wants out so he can go back there, which I absolutely 100% believe is true. I mean, I was in Miami for the Hall of Fame, and I listened to Ric Flair's entire speech, and he all but said, without actually saying it, that he was going to be back in WWE, that he wanted to come back to WWE. So I believe TNA is absolutely right about that. The rumors this week of Alex Shelley signing with WWE were a bit premature, but he did turn down a new deal with TNA and is on WWE's radar as they're looking for cruiserweight talent for that new network show I've mentioned here before. Perhaps with Raw going to 3 hours, they're looking at putting some of those guys on TV as well, which I've advocated. I think that would be a good idea. To me, Alex Shelley without Chris Sabin kind of sucks, just because I was a fan of the Motor City Machine Guns tag team, and they could really help reignite the tag team division in WWE. You know, they've had on television recently Titus O'Neil and Darren Young, Curt Hawkins and Tyler Rex. They have the Usos. I'm sure I'm missing somebody. Well, they have Ziggler and Swagger, although I still think Ziggler would be better on his own. But if you bring in the Motor City Machine Guns and maybe even one other team, you can have a real tag division in WWE for the first time in years. So it's kind of a shame that one is coming without the other. Shelley on his own, I just can't see WWE really doing much with him as a single star. But I don't know what Saban's contract status is with TNA. You know, he may be under contract for another 3 years for all I know. But the timing of the Alex Shelley stuff makes this all very interesting. TNA wants Wittenstein and WWE to return any confidential material they may have and do not destroy any of it, is, I believe, some wording that was put in the suit. They do not want any evidence or material or anything like that to be destroyed or misplaced by WWE. It's going to be fascinating to see how this all unfolds, but I will say this. TNA was put in a really, really bad situation by WWE when they announced they were inducting Flair into the Hall of Fame this year. You know, they didn't give TNA any advance notice. They didn't ask them for permission to use one of their contracted performers. They just went ahead, and they announced it on TV, and they put tickets on sale. Probably because they figured, who cares? You know, what could TNA possibly do to stop us? Now, if TNA were to say no, and they had refused to let Flair attend the ceremony, they'd come off looking really bad and really petty. Why won't you let this man accept this great honor, this great induction? And TNA looks like the bad guys. It's bad PR for them if they refused to let Flair attend the ceremony. So, of course, Dixie Carter talked about how happy she was for Rick and how could they deny him such a great honor, and they let him go to the Hall of Fame. Not only that, they allowed him to appear on television and at WrestleMania the following night. So it wasn't just, okay, we'll let Flair accept his induction into the Hall of Fame on Saturday, but you can't air it on USA, and he cannot appear at WrestleMania. It was nothing like that. And maybe Flair would have done what he wanted to do on his own because, hey, he's Ric Flair, and he's going to do what he wants. But TNA allowed it to happen. They gave him their blessing, which was nice of them. It was a nice, classy move on their part, but believe me, it had more to do with them realizing it's bad PR. We're going to look really, really shitty if we say no, you're not allowed to go. What they got in exchange for this, I have no idea, because there were negotiations that whole week, right down to the wire, between WWE and TNA. And I don't know how involved Triple H was in that. I think he was involved in some way. So TNA got something out of this. I know that TNA had requested a lot of different things, and WWE refused. So what they ended up getting, I don't know. They certainly didn't get an acknowledgement at the Hall of Fame or like a graphic on screen mentioning that Ric Flair is a TNA talent. Again, WWE turned down a lot of their requests. I think they reached an agreement to have one WWE star, either R-Truth or Christian, is who I've heard, appear on a future TNA DVD release. Because both Truth and Christian were former world champions in the promotion. They have a pretty rich history themselves in TNA. So if TNA, let's say, is putting together some sort of 10-year anniversary retrospective DVD this year, I could see where they might want Christian or Truth to be involved in that in some way and get some comments from them. I don't know if that's the case or not, but man, I mean, how whipped did TNA look coming out of that whole thing? They came across like the little school kid being bullied on the playground. And they probably had every right to sue the pants off WWE, and they chose not to fight that battle. So here we are now with allegations of WWE possibly using inside information, which, again, may or may not be true, and possibly raiding talent from TNA, and I say good for TNA. If this is true, I hope TNA prevails. It's about time they showed some spine and stood up for themselves. They need to put their foot down and let WWE know that we're not going to let you walk all over us. We're going to fight back. So we'll see how this all ends up. But again, if it is as it appears, and TNA's claims do have some merit to them, I hope they win. I don't know what they would win. I don't know if it's money. I don't know. But I certainly hope that they prevail in the end if this is true, because you got to put your foot down at some point and you know, stand down to your bully and tell them you're not going to be bullied around anymore. You know, we're not going to play these games. We're not just going to let you walk all over us because you're the big bad WWE with Jerry McDevitt and your, you know, legal team and all the money in the world. We're going to fight back. And it looks like that's what TNA is doing. Last Sunday, WWE held their Over the Limit pay-per-view from Raleigh, North Carolina. And as I mentioned earlier, I had a clean sweep in my predictions. I went 6-for-6, which is rare. There were more than six matches in the end, although I couldn't exactly look into my crystal ball and predict what they could be. So for the six matches that they actually did announce, I did get a clean sweep in my predictions. There were a total of four matches, including the Battle Royal, not previously announced on TV that ended up on this pay-per-view, which has to be some sort of record. The main event was like a snowman, abominable, just complete shit, with a finish that you could see coming 5 miles away. And that's not always a bad thing to go with the predictable finish, but it is bad when it's a predictably bad finish. This was also the fifth straight pay-per-view show, with both world title matches relegated to the undercard. The Rumble I'm fine with, because the Royal Rumble match should go on last, but what's their excuse for all the other pay-per-views? It'd be bad enough if that happened with one world title, but two? To have two world titles and both of them are on the undercard? On a positive note, there was positive on this show. This wasn't all bad. You know, the tag match with Kofi and Truth against Ziggler and Swagger was a pretty good little tag match. And, of course, the WWE Championship match. I mean, this show had what may turn out to be the best WWE match of the year between CM Punk and Daniel Bryan. So, you see, I have something nice to say. It's not all bad. Let's get into this here match by match. We'll start from the bottom and work our way up to the top. We had Kane and Zack Ryder. This was the pre-show match that aired online. It was exactly what I said it would be. Zack got killed by Kane. I believe he got the broski boot. He got a little bit of offense. But in the end, Kane killed him, pinned him. Really not much else to say about it. There was a Battle Royal. They did the Battle Royal intros on the pre-show. This was a little odd. It led into the pay-per-view. So when the pay-per-view went on the air, it went right into the Battle Royal. It was a cold open right into the first match, which was unusual, and I liked it. Now, they ended up airing the video and the pyro, but it came after the Battle Royal. So this was a little bit different. Christian made his comeback. He's been out of action with a litany of different injuries now for months, stemming originally from an ankle injury he suffered last year. They said he's also had neck problems, I think, and back problems, and I believe that's all true. So Christian finally made his big comeback here, and he won the Battle Royal. And he teased challenging Santino Marella for the U.S. title. Basically, the winner of the Battle Royal had the option of fighting either Cody Rhodes for the Intercontinental Championship or Santino for the U.S. title. Both men were sitting at ringside with their belts watching the Battle Royal. Christian won. It came down to Christian, David Otunga, and The Miz. And Christian worked as the babyface here. It was a little odd to see three guys who are all heels, although I guess the idea now is that Christian is a babyface, even though he didn't turn, and he's been portrayed as this, you know, sniveling, conniving, whiny little bitch for most of the last year. All of a sudden, he's a babyface, which he works very well as a babyface. I just thought it was a bit odd, and the crowd seemed to be confused as well because they didn't know who to cheer for. But Christian headbutted Miz. Both men were on the apron. He headbutted Miz. Miz fell to the floor, so Christian wins. This was what it was. It was, you know, it was every Battle Royal you've ever seen, really. Nothing particularly outstanding about it. Kofi Kingston and R-Truth successfully defended their tag titles against Ziggler and Swagger. As I said before, a pretty good tag match here. It had some time. Ziggler and Kofi, in particular, in the closing moments of the match, were just flying all over the place and just at warp speed. Ziggler was a bump machine. Kofi was really good, too. I like this. I'm actually happy that Ziggler took the fall and lost here because I am hoping that perhaps this is the catalyst for him to get back into meaningful singles matches instead of drowning in tag team purgatory, although he was right back to tag team action on Raw Monday night, so I guess maybe it didn't mean anything at all. But this was pretty good. Layla defended her Divas Championship successfully against Beth Phoenix. They tried to tell a story with Beth going after Layla's surgically repaired knee, but this just was not a very good match. Really sloppy in spots, actually. And you would think otherwise, because Layla's pretty good. Beth Phoenix is obviously very good. But this was not one of their better matches. And in the end, Layla nailed her neck breaker out of nowhere, got the pin. No karma, no nothing after the match. It just ended, and that was that. Then we had the World Championship on the line, the Fatal 4-Way match. Sheamus, Randy Orton, Chris Jericho, and Alberto Del Rio. This was Lillian Garcia's first botch. She did not have a good night. And this was her first botch when she was introducing each man. She announced that Sheamus weighed in at 227 pounds, same weight as Chris Jericho. And I remember thinking to myself, there's no way Sheamus weighs 227. And if he does, there's no way they would announce him at 227. In wrestler weight, 227 is more like 256 when you embellish. So anyway, the match itself was actually really good for a four-way, which, again, triple threat matches and fatal four-ways are tough to do just because you always have the same spots. You know, the focus has to be on any two guys at once. You always have these spots where one guy gets knocked out of the ring, or, you know, there's two guys brawling on the outside and two guys in the ring, and they kind of take their turns. And then the two guys in the ring eventually will kind of step aside so the other two guys can come and do their thing. And in terms of four ways, I thought this was very good. Second best thing on the show, easily. Funny how the two world title matches were the best things on the show, and the babyface went over in both of those matches, which WWE likes to end pay-per-views with, and yet neither of these matches was good enough to actually headline the show. And the stuff at the end was really good. Sheamus ended up pinning Jericho with his white noise move to win the title, to retain the title, I should say, so Sheamus stays champion, as I predicted. Brodus Clay and The Miz, they tossed this match on the pay-per-view. He dropped Miz with a fallaway slam, gave him the big splash for the pin. They brought the kids into the ring to dance with Brodus, Naomi, and Cameron. And this had no business being on pay-per-view. That's probably the best thing I could say about it. Cody Rhodes and Christian for the Intercontinental title. Christian won what I believe they said is his fourth Intercontinental Championship with the kill switch. He played the role of babyface, just as he did in the Battle Royal. As I said, he's very good at that, but would have made more sense for him to at least cut a promo explaining why he's back and why he's all of a sudden interested in going after the bad guys and whatever. especially the kids. I said before that you could tell people in the crowd were confused, the kids in particular, because the last time they saw Christian, like I said, he was begging for one more match. He just was this giant brat. And all of a sudden, he's a good guy. But you know what? He did get a year-long run as a top heel, and he got two world title runs out of it. So, yeah, even if one of those runs was 48 hours long, he still won the world title twice, so that's something. So, yeah, he's the new Intercontinental Champion. Then we have the WWE Championship match. CM Punk and Daniel Bryan. This was awesome. A-W-E-S-O-M-E, awesome. It's probably my favorite WWE match of the year up to this point. And that's coming off Bryan's match with Sheamus at Extreme Rules last month, which I also felt was the best wrestling match on that entire show. So you see a pattern developing here with Daniel Bryan being involved in these different matches. Anyway, this match rocked, as I said. They gave them over 20 minutes. They gave us what felt like, in some ways, an old-school ROH match that was mixed in with the current style. It was a nice blending of the styles. Punk busted out a curb stomp on Bryan, which I don't think we've seen on WWE TV since Paul Burchill used that move a couple of times. Bryan put Punk in a La Tapatia during the match, or Mexican surfboard, which looked cool as hell. Tons of kicks and just way too much stuff to cover here. And the match had a somewhat disputed finish in that Bryan had Punk in the Yes Lock and was rocking back and forth. But he rocked back a little too much, and Punk had Bryan's shoulders down for the 1-2-3. So Punk won the match fair and square, but he also tapped out right after the bell. And Bryan was no worse for wear when the match was over, so it's not like he was laid out or anything. So you can make the argument that Punk only barely won the match by the skin of his teeth. So this did ruin the match for me because I quickly realized, you know, holy shit, we're going to get a rematch, and I was very excited. I am totally, totally fine with that. In fact, they could make this feud the Randy Orton vs. Christian of 2012 for all I care and just let them headline the next five pay-per-views. I could watch these two guys wrestle all day long. The finish also reminded me of the first Kurt Angle-Chris Benoit match on pay-per-view at WrestleMania X7, which people also had very high expectations for, and it was a very good match, but they did this weird finish that led to several rematches between the two men that were even better. I think Angle, I don't know if Angle cheated to win that match or he just kind of rolled through something. It was one of those finishes like this one that came out of nowhere that some people were disappointed in, but again, it led to so many more Angle versus Benoit matches that were so much better that people were fine with it. So major props also to the crowd and Rally for this. They helped make this match something special. I always worry when they take two guys like a Bryan and a Punk and they put them in a wrestling match and you don't have that big star like a John Cena or Randy Orton, because sometimes the fans just won't react or they'll sit on their hands. Sometimes they'll chant boring because these are stupid people. But in this case, they gave these guys a hell of an ovation for almost everything they did. I mean, these people were reacting. They were totally into it. They had dueling chants at one point for Punk and Bryan. Actually, at many different points in the match, there were dueling chants. There was a "This is awesome" chant later in the match, which it was. So, you see, if you show people what great wrestling is, they will love it. Best thing on the entire show by a country mile. This match was awesome. Then we had Ryberg and Camacho. This was the second botch by Lillian Garcia. She announced Junico as Ryback's opponent instead of Camacho. And if you paid close attention, you could see referee Charles Robinson just standing there as she announces Junico, and he just has the most confused look on his face. It was quite hilarious. So Goldback pinned Camacho in about 2 minutes. This had even less business being on pay-per-view than Brodus Clay versus The Miz. You know, it really struck me here how much damage WWE is doing by turning their pay-per-views into glorified Raw shows. I'm not saying the idea of putting a buffer match between your main events to bring the crowd down is a bad idea, but do it with the women's match. Or if you're going to add a crappy match like this, add one. Don't add four unannounced crappy matches. You know what four matches is? That's half a pay-per-view right there. Actually, if a pay-per-view card, let's say, averages seven matches, that's more than half. You've now filled your show up with more than 50% garbage that people don't want to see. That's what they're doing here. And then they wonder why more people won't pay to see Brock Lesnar on a B-level show. It's because by doing stuff like this, you're conditioning people to think that these shows aren't special. So why spend the money on them? I mean, there are many reasons these shows don't do well, but I'm telling you, they're doing a lot of damage when they pull shit like this. Four matches on this show that had not been announced that people could not give a shit about. Unbelievable. Then we had the main event. John Cena and John Laurinaitis. Or Austin vs. McMahon 2, as I like to call it, which would also be appropriate. Only these guys are not Steve Austin and Vince McMahon, I could tell you that. But I mean, think about it. Almost to a T, the similarities are kind of eerie. You know, it's the evil boss against the babyface employee. Going into that match with Austin and McMahon in 99, Shawn Michaels was the commissioner, and he stacked the deck against Vince McMahon by putting him against his biggest rival in a cage. Here, the board of directors stacked the deck against Laurinaitis by barring any superstars from interfering and saying that if he lost, he was fired. Then the babyface proceeds to beat the crap out of the evil authority figure for 95% of the match, in both cases. Then the babyface is made to look like a complete dumb shit when he has the match won, but he chooses to fight on instead. I mean, with Austin, he was halfway out of the cage. Remember that, when McMahon flipped him the bird? So Austin climbed back inside instead of first climbing down to win the match? Here, Laurinaitis survived not one but two STF submissions, and Cena let go of the hold. Both times. And to top it all off, the Big Show interferes in the Austin McMahon match and helps Vince McMahon. And in this match, lo and behold, who should interfere? Why, it's the Big Show, who comes out to help John Laurinaitis. Only this time, it actually results in the heel pinning the babyface, whereas in that cage match 13 years ago, Austin still found a clever way to succeed, and therefore he doesn't look like as much of a dumb shit when all is said and done. God, that STF stuff just had me shaking my head in this match. How many guys have we seen on Raw, or even on pay-per-view, tap out to John Cena's STF in like 3 seconds when Cena locks it on? And John Laurinaitis survived a total of 20 seconds without ever tapping. And they wonder why we can't take any of the younger guys on that roster seriously. This was just atrocious. It had no business being the main event of the show, especially if they love sending people home happy by having the babyface go over in the end, which they've done on every single pay-per-view show going back to at least Survivor Series last year. I, for one, I don't subscribe to that theory. I say if you have a strong angle or a strong heel and want to put them over, then that's what you do. John Laurinaitis is not that person. But he did win, as I predicted. John Cena knocked off Brock Lesnar, the former UFC champion, but by God, Big Johnny was just too much for him to handle. I know some of you found the match to be entertaining. Look, that Austin vs. McMahon cage match was not exactly Luthez and Carl Gotch, but at least Vince took a big bump off the cage to the floor. The biggest bump Laurinaitis took here was accidentally ramming his own head into the apron when John Cena tried to throw him into the ring, which looked like it sucked, by the way. He's lucky he didn't get hurt on that. But Laurinaitis managed to scramble away through the crowd, only to be brought back into the ring by the fired Big Show, so way to go security, letting him into the building. He teased giving Johnny a chokeslam. It looked like Laurinaitis was talking to him. I figured that it wasn't a Big Show heel turn so much as it was Laurinaitis begging for his life and telling Big Show that he would give him his job back if he would attack John Cena instead, which is exactly what happened, even though it turned out that that's not what Johnny was saying to him, so who the hell knows what that was all about. But Big Show delivered the knockout punch to John Cena, which allowed Laurinaitis to make the cover. He got the pin. This sucked. The fact that they followed up that awesome CM Punk vs. Daniel Bryan match with this, as far as I'm concerned, was an insult. This is not how you end a pay-per-view. If you've got a really good angle plan, then go for it. This was not a really good angle. This was amateur hour. This sucked. And I don't know what else to say about it. It left a really bad taste in my mouth. And it just goes to show you, it's not how you start, it's how you end. It's how you finish. That's an expression that I've heard repeated so many different times. And in this case, it's almost a perfect expression to use. Because if you would have taken this shit match and put this as the second or third match from the top, okay? Or rather, the second or third match from the bottom, let's say, and you would have ended the pay-per-view with Bryan and Punk, imagine how much more positive people would feel coming out of that pay-per-view if you would have ended with that 23-minute awesome match instead of ending with this shit. It's not how you start, it's how you finish, and the way they finished this show sucked. So that brings us to Monday Night Raw, which emanated from Richmond, Virginia this week, and I hate to be railing on WWE even more, but that's what I'm going to do because I didn't like Raw this week. I actually caught Impact Wrestling, and I thought it was a much better show. The Cena-Laurinaitis stuff was just really bad. Big Show was great, showing passion in his promo, but doesn't mean I have to like this angle, which I don't. Especially when they think I'm too stupid to realize when things don't make sense. I mean, this storyline has more holes in it than Swiss cheese. Let's be honest. I don't watch too many other shows on TV. I mean, I watch a few. I watch The Walking Dead, which I think is a great show, and I used to watch The Shield on FX when it was on. Best show of all time, in my opinion. I'm not as geeky about other TV shows as I am when it comes to wrestling, so I'm just wondering if when people get together in, like, fan club groups, or they listen to podcasts that are devoted to, like, the latest episode of Walking Dead, let's say, or Breaking Bad, or Grey's Anatomy, or whatever shit it may be, if it's important to those people that things on those shows make sense. Maybe people can help me out with this if you guys have a favorite TV show and you do that sort of thing. Is it important to you that the TV shows make sense? Do they talk about that sort of thing, like plot holes and stuff like that? Or do they just give the writers a pass if they script shit that doesn't make any sense and they just laugh it off? I'm willing to bet that doesn't happen. They probably care about little plot holes and stuff like that, right? I really want to know, because why, if these guys so badly want to be considered a TV show and not a wrestling show, why do they think it's okay to just not pay any attention to their own stories and make sure they at least make sense? I don't buy into the whole, oh, it's just wrestling, stop criticizing every little thing and enjoy it. I think that's bullshit. I really do. So John Cena came out to open the show, and he was angry for a change. He embraced the hate, I guess. Couldn't understand how he lost to John Laurinaitis. I can. It's because you're stupid. You had the man beat and you let him go. That makes you a fool. So then Cena, i.e. Vince McMahon, got all defensive about people bringing up that very fact that he should have just finished off Johnny rather than toying with him. He said that if Big Show was already paid off, he would have cost him the match either way. Oh, really? Show me this fucking jetpack that you've created for Big Show at 400 pounds, mind you, that would allow him to get to the ring in time to break up those two STF submissions that you slapped on Laurinaitis. That was a goddamn stupid thing for him to say. And it only got worse. Angry Cena started cracking jokes because he just can't help himself. Laurinaitis came out on a Rascal scooter fitted with a People Power logo on the front, which was kind of funny. This is even more of an Austin McMahon ripoff. Remember Vince was in the wheelchair for months after Undertaker and Kane broke his ankle? I'm just waiting now for John Cena to kidnap Laurinaitis, wheel him to the ring, and put a gun to Johnny's head. Only instead of a little flag popping out that says Bang 316, it shoots rainbows and Ovaltine. So Johnny said that no one can lay a finger on him or they will be fired. Which kind of kills the whole firing people gimmick when you do this whole big, elaborate firing in the ring with Big Show one week and then he's back the next. Out comes Big Show in a suit, and he explains that John Laurinaitis rehired him on Saturday. Now, I had already checked out of this segment after the Cena BS earlier, and I had actually missed this at first. My Twitter feed blew up, and I was quickly informed of what Big Show had just said. And apparently WWE's Twitter feed blew up as well, because they had Michael Cole do damage control on the show and issue a half-assed clarification of this a couple of segments later, actually. If the Big Show was rehired on Saturday, that makes him a WWE superstar. Per the rules of the match on Sunday, if any WWE superstar interfered in the main event on Sunday, then they would be fired. Big Show interfered in the match and isn't fired. Michael Cole would later tell us that, you see, Big Show only came to a verbal agreement with Big Johnny on Saturday, but the actual contract wasn't signed until after the show on Sunday. It's the best they could do to try to explain their way out of this one, but that shit don't fly. I thought maybe Laurinaitis fucked up in his promo, but in fact, this was written into the script exactly as read. Incredible. So many people complained about this, they had to essentially rebook the show on the air. That also makes two firing stipulations that they reneged on in the course of 1 week. That's a new record. Big Show said he doesn't owe anyone any explanation for his actions. He did what any one of us would have done. He said he would be wrestling John Cena at No Way Out, presumably in a cage, since all the main events on that show will be cage matches. How's this for a did-you-know factoid? No Way Out will mark 5 straight pay-per-views with John Cena in the main event and both world titles relegated to the undercard. Just put the title back on Cena if that's the case. I never thought I'd hear myself say that, nor do I think Cena needs the championship, but for the sake of your WWE title, it should be on your top guy. CM Punk is obviously not your top guy. John Cena is. So just put it back on him if that's the case. Cena beat David Otunga quickly with the STF. I should note that Otunga tapped out to the STF in about 3 seconds. Remember, John Laurinaitis was trapped in that hold for a total of 20 seconds and never tapped out. That's important. Curt Hawkins, Tyler Rex, Titus O'Neil, and Darren Young came out and attacked Cena. Sheamus ran out to make the save, and in doing so, he bumped into Laurinaitis and knocked him over. That should mean that Sheamus is fired, but of course he isn't. Laurinaitis made a first-ever 3-on-2 handicap lumberjack match for the main event. He said he would not reveal who Cena and Sheamus' opponents were until later in the show. Santino and Ricardo Rodriguez did some comedy in the ring. Santino did the ring intro for Alberto Del Rio. They announced that Raw will become the only weekly TV show to go 3 hours this July, which I guess means that WCW never existed to them. Well, those who ignore history are doomed to repeat it, I suppose. Randy Orton beat Del Rio by DQ after the Brazilian Badass, as I will now refer to him. Chris Jericho ran down and gave Orton 3 code breakers to set up a match at the pay-per-view that will no longer be taking place. Daniel Bryan came out. He said that it was an injustice. He was not the WWE champion since he made CM Punk tap out. He demanded a rematch. Punk came out, ended up announcing that Bryan was going to wrestle Kane. Between this and the stuff they did with Kane on SmackDown this week, I am terrified that they're going to work him into that next Punk-Bryan match at the pay-per-view. Although I will say that Daniel Bryan absolutely murdered Kane with chair shots on SmackDown this week. That was quite awesome. So Bryan beat Kane here by DQ after Kane killed him with chair shots, then gave him 2 chokeslams and left. CM Punk went to go check on Bryan and put him in the Anaconda Vice. Please don't make this a 3-way with Kane. I just don't do it. Then again, if Jericho is really off the pay-per-view, that leaves Randy Orton as a man without an opponent. So, do you put Kane with Punk and Bryan, or do you have yet another Orton versus Kane match? I mean, God, that's like asking someone if they would rather drown or be burned alive. I don't think I can bring myself to choose either one of those options. Backstage, AJ acted all crazy with CM Punk. She was crying 1 minute and smiling the next. Next thing you know, Punk is going to come home to his apartment in Chicago and find rabbit stew on the stove. That's an old movie reference for all you youngsters out there. Christian beat Jinder Mahal. That old school Intercontinental title looks good around his waist, I must say. Actually, that Intercontinental Championship looks good, period. It's nice to have a championship belt that doesn't look like a goddamn trinket. You know, it doesn't look like a joke. Beth Phoenix beat Kelly Kelly. The match hit 2 minutes 28 seconds on my Diva stopwatch this week, so they're creeping up bit by bit. You know, maybe next week they'll hit 3 minutes. Main event was John Cena and Sheamus going to a no contest in a 3-on-2 handicap lumberjack match against Jack Swagger, Dolph Ziggler, and Tensai. Yes, he is now just Tensai, and he has no ring outfit. Heels beat on Sheamus forever until the World Heavyweight Champion made the hot tag to John Cena, which seems rather ass-backwards to me, to have your World Heavyweight Champion get his ass handed to him for 15 minutes and make the hot tag to John Cena, who was in fact not a champion. All the lumberjacks who were heels, they ran in to interfere. Then all the babyfaces came out from the back. There was a big brawl, which looked kind of cool. John Cena fled backstage in search of the Big Show, who one would think is not a hard man to find, given that he's over 7 feet, 400 pounds. But Cena couldn't find him. Turned around and got punched in the face and knocked out by Big Show, and that was that. That was Raw. So a largely boring show. Impact Wrestling, on the other hand, I actually caught most of Impact this week, the final taped show before they go live at 8 p.m. next week, and I thought it was a good show. It was open fight night, and I enjoyed the opening sequence backstage. They had the intro with Hulk Hogan and Kurt Angle, AJ Styles, Jeff Hardy, and Bully Ray were all in Hulk's office. And they had this really dramatic music playing in the background, which I thought was actually a nice touch. I'm not always a fan of this sort of thing. You know, WWE had this horrible habit, particularly with Kane promos, whenever Kane would cut those long, drawn-out monologues. Week after week, they'd play the cheesy music in the background while he talked, and I thought that sucked. This was different. This was, I guess, a little bit cheesy, but it worked. The way that this was shot, the production of this video, I actually thought it was very impressive. It was different. It worked for me. I don't know about Hogan handing out the script for the show, but they called it the rundown sheet, so I guess I'm okay with it just because they didn't refer to it as a script. It didn't bother me that much. Bully Ray is phenomenal. As much as I'd like to see him in WWE, and I think he could be a top heel in WWE, I don't want him to leave TNA. WWE would just water him down so much that it just wouldn't be the same. Hogan eliminated Bully as a possible opponent for Bobby Roode later in the night and said that he would choose Roode's opponent later on. The story here was that if Bobby Roode retained his world title on this show, he would officially become the longest reigning champion in Impact Wrestling history. Yes, in Impact Wrestling history, perhaps, but Jeff Jarrett actually had a much longer reign as the NWA champion in the early days of TNA by, like, I think something like well over 100 days. So not that his reign was well over 100 days, but he's got Bobby Roode's current reign beat by at least that much. So in terms of Impact Wrestling, the current era, then I guess, yes, Bobby Roode now is officially the longest reigning champion. But he would have to get past his opponent on this show in order to become that. And actually, thinking of Jeff Jarrett's reign back in the day in TNA, I guess that was kind of their own version of the Reign of Terror, a la Triple H, where every single match that Jarrett had would end with just massive interference. I think everybody in the world would run into that. Now, I may have even run into one of Jeff Jarrett's matches at one point. I don't remember. But they had interference, and they had guitar shots. It was all of this fluff and this plunder. Every match would end the same way. Those were some dark days, in a way, for TNA, I would say, during the Jeff Jarrett era back then. But anyway, so that's the story with Bobby Roode. The angle they did on this show with Bully Ray and Joseph Park I thought was well done. It's still amazing to me that it's Abyss playing that role. It's just so different from the Abyss character. He's really good at it. You know what I mean? He's just really good. And I don't know where all of this is leading, but I will take Joseph Park Esquire over David Otunga any day of the week. And Bully Ray left him laying at the end of their segment. What was also great about this was Bully Ray telling Joseph Park, who was in the crowd as a fan, he was looking for Joseph Park, and they showed him in the crowd eating popcorn just like any other fan. And he told him to get his ass into the ring, and Joseph Park stalls. You know, he comes over the through the barricade, and he's about to walk into the ring, and he stalls like he's all nervous to get inside, and the fans just erupt into chants of, yes, yes, yes. So first it was the what chant overseas. Remember that, was it the UK Impact or whatever it was with the what chant that infected the TNA product? Well, now the yes chant has spread to TNA. And I will take the yes chant over the what chant any day of the week. So this was good. Austin Aries beat Joey Ryan in a gut check match. Ryan looked okay. To be honest, he didn't really do much for me, but we will find out next week what the judges thought of his performance and if they offer him a contract. Aries beat him in about 5 minutes with a brain buster. And you know what? With the gut check stuff, at least they're giving new guys a chance to shine on TV. I can't really find too much fault with it. You can find fault with the way they kind of handle it. Why we have to wait a week to find out what the judges think is kind of stupid to me. I just think it's dumb. Even on like reality TV shows like Dancing with the Stars, they have judges that rank your performance. And the next night, let's say they'll have a second show, the result show, where one team gets eliminated, which I understand that. That's done for ratings. But it's not like you dance, and then the judges tell you, well, we're not going to hold up our scores until tomorrow, you know, or next week you'll have to tune in. That would be fucking stupid. There's a reason that that sort of thing is not done that way. So I think that's kind of stupid. But aside from that, the gut check thing I think is a positive. Just because Joey Ryan wasn't overly impressive to me doesn't mean that they won't bring in more people that could add something of value to the TNA roster, so I think it's a good thing. Main event on this show had Bobby Roode against AJ Styles for the TNA World Heavyweight Championship in a very good 20-minute match. He beat Styles to retain his TNA title. I'd say this was the second-best match of the week behind Bryan vs. Punk at Over the Limit. Compared to the Raw main event, this may well have been Michaels vs. Undertaker at WrestleMania 25. After the match, Bobby Roode threw himself a big celebration for becoming the longest reigning champion. They had tons of confetti falling from the ceiling. He broke out the bottle of champagne, which he proceeded to pour on his head, which was dumb because he looked like his eyes were burning. He couldn't even really open them for a good minute or two after. Hulk Hogan came down to the ring, and you know when Hogan's music started playing and he was coming down, they had a shot of Bobby Roode, who I guess was supposed to look at the aisleway and be shocked or whatever, but he just kept closing his eyes and trying to wipe the champagne out of his eyes, and he was squinting. I felt sorry for the poor guy. So Hogan comes to the ring. He congratulates Bobby Roode, and then he introduces the returning Sting as his opponent for next week's Live Impact. They had a shot of Roode in the aisleway after Sting dumped him. And Rude was doing his best Wrath of Khan impersonation here. He was on his knees, looking up at the sky, screaming, "Hogan!" And I just laughed at that. I thought that was great. So, we get Bobby Roode and Sting on Impact next week. They didn't say it was for the championship, which I think is telling. When they don't tell you that it's for the title, that usually indicates non-title. And it will be a lumberjack match. I believe it's a lumberjack match. Maybe I'm wrong, actually. Maybe I'm getting this confused with Raw. I'm pretty sure they announced that it would be a lumberjack match. I could just be getting my two shows completely mixed up, though. But the reason they're doing this is because next week's Impact is a very big show for the company. It's the first show in the new 8 p.m. time slot. They're moving up 1 hour, so don't forget about that. It's the first live Impact for the summer. And who knows? I mean, if Impact does well in the ratings this summer, if they gain a couple of tenths of a point, you know, Impact could go live for good. I mean, there's a lot of expense that's included in doing Impact live, and there's less room for error. There's going to be more fuck-ups on TV. It's just, it's something that has to be accepted. When you're taping TV every single week and you're going to suddenly go live without any advance warning and you don't have a chance to rehearse or practice for a few weeks in advance, you know, people are going to fuck things up. Let's hope they don't fuck up too much. And, of course, Brooke Hogan will also make her debut on Impact next week live, so who knows what her performance will be like. But, you know, Hogan took his time at the end of the show to announce to everybody, listen, next week we're on the air at 8 o'clock, we're live, Sting is back. You know, the show is going to start. It's going to be Sting and Bobby Roode, which, you know, you could say is a pay-per-view caliber match, but in TNA, you got to throw that away. That whole mentality with TNA about, oh my God, I can't believe they gave this match on free TV, just throw it away because it doesn't count. TNA doesn't care about pay-per-view. TV is their bread and butter, and this is a big show next week, and they want to give one of their biggest matches. I don't know that Sting and Bobby Roode is the biggest match that you could do, but it's a big match. Sting's been off TV, I think, since the last pay-per-view. And they did everything in their power to get people to tune into that show next week, so I give them a lot of credit for that. Like I said, Impact I thought was good this week, and certainly better than Raw. Raw left me with a bad taste in my mouth, and Impact was a fine wrestling show. And I will give them a chance next week. I'm looking forward to checking out that live Impact, and we'll see if they can keep the momentum going. You know, Russo now has been gone for a little while, which is not to say that every single episode of Impact, from what I understand, has been good since Russo left. But the show, to me, in watching it, just seemed to be more focused. There wasn't as much crap going on. Things certainly seemed to make a hell of a lot more sense than they did on Monday night, I can tell you that much. And as a fan, I can appreciate that. And I was not offended by Impact, and so I look forward to the live show next week. Talk about buy rates here for a second, for those people who are interested in that sort of thing. The latest pay-per-view buy rate figures were released by WWE this week, on Tuesday, to be specific. And they showed that WrestleMania 28 actually did about 1.25 million buys worldwide, which is actually down from their initial estimate of 1.3 million. They rushed out that press release all those weeks ago because they wanted everybody to know that, you know, the initial estimates show that we have set the all-time record. And of course, they may have jumped the gun on that one, because if this number sticks, then this is, in fact, not the all-time record, which means that the Donald Trump record from WrestleMania 23 still stands, which means my original prediction is true, which makes me very happy. I had originally predicted that it would not beat the Trump buy rate, although I did say the buy rate, I think the estimate that I gave for the WrestleMania buy rate before the show was like 950,000, so I was wrong about that. They were higher than that. But I was not convinced that they were going to beat that Trump WrestleMania, and as of right now, they have not. But the number is still fluid, so it could very well end up creeping higher and setting the record. But for now, it is not the all-time record. And we also got the numbers for Extreme Rules, featuring Brock Lesnar's big comeback to WWE against John Cena. That pay-per-view did 251,000 buys worldwide, 147,000 of which came from North America. That's up from the 216,000 worldwide buys that Extreme Rules did last year, which also had John Cena in the main event. Surprise, surprise. I believe it is the highest B-show pay-per-view buy rate since Money in the Bank last year, which had the big John Cena CM Punk match in Chicago. This show only did about 8,000 more buys domestically than that show did, which, you know, you'd have to think is a disappointment, a very big disappointment. Not a shock, mind you, since they seem to be doing everything in their power to kill B-shows, which I talked about earlier. But still, you've got Brock Lesnar making his grand return to the ring for the first time in 8 years, a man who became UFC heavyweight champion and a much bigger celebrity outside of wrestling than he ever was inside of it, who became one of the hottest pay-per-view attractions anywhere in the world. I mean, aside from Mayweather and Pacquiao, I think Brock Lesnar was it. Brock Lesnar was the biggest pay-per-view box office attraction, aside from those guys, since the days of Mike Tyson. And this pay-per-view ends up really not doing all that well, all things considered. And that's not an indictment on Brock Lesnar's drawing power, as far as I'm concerned. That's on WWE. Like I said before, they've got a lot of work to do if these B-shows are going to be taken seriously. And who knows? I mean, there was talk that when the network launches, they may just move most of these B-shows to the network and just not even put them on pay-per-view. Maybe that's the plan. Maybe they've already in their minds given up. They can put four matches on Over the Limit that they didn't announce in advance. They could put a Ryback squash match on pay-per-view, and who cares? Who cares? So if that's their mentality and they're just going to move these shows to the network at the end of the year, then you know what? Fine. In the meantime, though, don't expect much of a return on your investment. Why waste Brock Lesnar's first match back, and a big match, too, against John Cena, maybe the biggest match they could do, aside from maybe, you know, Lesnar and Undertaker? Why put that on Extreme Rules and rush it on to pay-per-view 3 weeks later? Because in the end, this is what happens. Maybe Brock Lesnar, if they would have waited until the B-show in June, which is No Way Out, which I guess is all cage matches, so maybe that wouldn't have worked. But if you really wanted, you just could not wait until SummerSlam. And I admit, you know, you sign Brock Lesnar to a multi-million dollar deal, you want to start getting something back. I understand that. SummerSlam is still a ways off. So instead of Extreme Rules, wait until No Way Out. Build it up a little bit. Now, that video they did was awesome. You know, the Brock Lesnar video package that they kind of modeled after those UFC countdown shows. But that was phenomenal stuff. But that's just one video. Apparently, it didn't do the job. But Brock Lesnar did. Brock Lesnar did do the job to John Cena. And I guess, thankfully, the only saving grace is that only 250,000 people saw it. It could have been a lot worse. So that's one way to look at it. Let's get into the shout-outs here. Actually, before I get to the shout-outs, I have one quick story to mention. I mentioned this on Twitter. My brother actually mentioned to me this week that on Jeopardy, there was a question. I don't know what the category was. Maybe if somebody watched this, they could fill me in on this. I don't know if it was a wrestling category. I don't believe it was. But there was a question about a move that places a person's back on the canvas. Okay, that was, you know, in Jeopardy, they give you the answer first, and then you have to give them the question. But that was the answer. It's a move that places a person's back on the canvas. And one of the contestants answered with the word slam. And Alex Trebek told him to be more specific. And instead of responding by saying body slam, this dope responded by saying grand slam. Perhaps he was thinking of Denny's when he answered that question. I have no idea what was going through this person's mind. You would think the word body slam is a common term. Like, even non-wrestling fans know what a body slam is, right? Am I right about that? I figure everybody knows what a body slam is. But now I'm, like, so curious. I would love a wrestler to actually start using a grand slam as his finishing maneuver. He would become my favorite wrestler if somebody starts using the grand slam as their finish. I think that would be phenomenal. Okay, now let's get into the shout-outs here. You can send them in to me via email at thesolemonster@gmail.com. That goes for both shout-outs and mailbag questions. Got several of them, actually, this week to get to. First and foremost, I want to congratulate our own Jacob from Wichita, big fan of the show. He graduated from high school this past week. I guess now he can get his degree in thugonomics if he wants to go that direction. So congrats to Jacob. Luis from Los Angeles would like to give a birthday shout-out to Cindy Lopez, who celebrated her 19th birthday on May 26th. So happy birthday to Cindy. Rick from South Carolina, also celebrating a birthday on May 26th. He turned 21, so happy birthday, Rick. Orlando Garcia writes in, says, I'm a big fan of the podcast since episode 84. My birthday was May 24th, and I wanted to see if I can get a birthday shout-out. So happy birthday, Orlando. He says that one thing he would like to do someday is have a beer with the Solomonster. Would you be open to the idea? Well, you know, the best beer is a free beer, so only if you're buying. But who knows? If we're ever at the same show or something, I wouldn't be against the idea. It could be fun. Adam writes in. He's been a listener since episode 62. He says, I've had a hectic couple of weeks with my aunt having a stroke and my uncle getting a double lung transplant. I was wondering if you can give my boyfriend a shout-out. He enjoys hearing you read out my questions, so I figured he may enjoy a shout-out. We celebrated our 3-year anniversary on May 19th. Don't say that date. But with everything going on, I wasn't able to send in a request sooner. Thanks for all your hard work. Your podcasts make working overnight stocking shelves a bit more bearable. So that comes from Adam. Congrats to him. Flint in Beijing, China writes in. Wow. Shout out from China here. He says, can I get a shout out for all the Solid Monster fans all over the world who have been loyal fans for so long? Also, which current WWE superstars are dating? Well, how should I know? Do I look like TMZ to you? I know Miz is still with Maryse, who left the company. Cody Rhodes is still dating Eden Styles, the former ring announcer for Superstars, who also left the company. And I believe Daniel Bryan is or was dating Brie Bella, who also left the company. This is actually quite the interesting pattern that we've developed here with all these divas that have left the company. But that's all I know. Beyond that, I know Triple H and Stephanie are together. Beyond that, I don't know what else to offer you on that. And lastly, I know he's probably not listening to this. In fact, I know he isn't. But my little brother Jonathan is celebrating a birthday today, actually, May 27th. So I wanted to wish him a happy birthday as well. I don't know why, if he's not listening to my show, little bastard. But there you go. Happy birthday to him. We have time for a few questions here for the mailbag this week. Email me at thesolemonster@gmail.com. I responded directly to a whole bunch of people this week. I tried to get caught up on some emails. So even if I don't get you on the air, I try to get people directly. So email me there. This question here, we'll start with Stephen, who writes in. And basically, this is Stephen from Leicester, England. Wants to ask me about the draft, making it important. Why don't they, instead of drafting Raw SmackDown stars, when they launch NXT and the supposed Cruiserweight show on TV, why don't they draft NXT and Cruiserweight stars to Raw or SmackDown? And if they want fan interaction, they can vote for who they want to see on WWE TV, and WWE can just decide where to put them. Here's one thing I would mention before I answer your question here, which I already did directly. But one other caveat here, just to mention about the fan interactivity. NXT Season 2, I believe it was the season with Caval. And the people loved Caval. People wanted Caval to win. I think he actually did win, if I remember correctly. But it didn't matter, because Caval was put on TV with Lay Cool. He was made to look pussy-whipped. They didn't do anything with him, and they fired him. They didn't do anything with Caval, and now Low-Ki is back on the indies, you know, doing what he does best. And I've heard stories about Low-Ki and his attitude, and he may not be the easiest person in the world to work with, but he's a talented guy, and the fans were getting into him. And WWE, the fan voting there, I think, was legit, and I don't know if they had their own personal preference. I don't remember anybody else from that season off the top of my head. I just know that Caval was part of it, and the people voted him in. The people voting on certain stars can sometimes actually work to that star's disadvantage. I know that sounds completely ass-backwards, but if WWE, let's say, has somebody they want on TV, or they have a competition and they want somebody to win, and they don't because they let the fans legitimately vote, it's almost like their way of saying, F you to the fans, we're not going to push this person. So I don't know that that's necessarily the wisest idea for some of these guys, but I think that Steven's idea is actually much more productive than having a regular draft. A regular draft is completely pointless at this point. Not one person listening to the show can give me a valid reason for having a regular draft, because those days are over. You have Raw Super Show every week. People go back and forth between Raw and SmackDown all the time. People don't care. People don't take that seriously. A draft, if they're going to do a draft show at some point to try to pop a rating, I think those draft shows stopped popping ratings years ago. But if you wanted to do a draft, which can be a fun thing to do, it would make sense to make some of those guys, the younger guys that you talked about, feel special right out of the gate. You can work it like the NBA draft. You know, you could have videos that show these guys like a Seth Rollins or a Dean Ambrose or a Richie Steamboat, show them in action, put their stats up on the screen and list their previous accomplishments and really make them feel like a big deal. But Triple H has his own ideas about how guys should debut, giving them gimmicks and airing vignettes for them, so I doubt they would consider this. And I don't think that's a good idea for everybody. For example, Dean Ambrose is somebody who I expect to be on TV very soon, possibly by the time Raw goes 3 hours in July. Who knows? Maybe he'll debut on that show and they'll start something with him and Mick Foley. But Dean Ambrose is the kind of guy who, you know, I wouldn't necessarily want to see him in a draft show. I think you can do a, quote, typical wrestling debut with him where he just shows up on a show once and beats the hell out of John Cena. Or if Mick Foley, I had this idea in my head where if they're not going to bring Ambrose in before the Raw 1000th episode on July 23rd, I have a great way to introduce him. If you're keeping up with this whole Ambrose-Foley feud, which seems to have quieted down recently, I hope they didn't drop it. But you would expect that maybe Mick Foley, for example, would be an invited guest, right? One of these legends that they invite on their 1000th episode. And that's the perfect place to do something with Ambrose, whether Ambrose physically attacks him and then has to be pulled off of Foley by officials and they pretend that they don't know who this guy is, or Foley is out there and then Ambrose comes out to cut a promo on him and they start their feud that way. I mean, that might be the best time to do it. But you have these other guys like a Richie Steamboat, or I know they have other guys like Leo Kruger and Mike Dalton and Seth Rollins and Cassius Ohno and these people down in developmental who, you know, you can do a draft and really make them feel special. I think that's actually a really cool idea, which means they probably won't do it. Jason Campbell writes in, two questions actually. First, why are almost all the WWE stars coming in or being brought up recently from FCW all heels? Lesnar, Tensai, Sandow, O'Neil and Young, Cesaro appears to be a heel, Ambrose looks like he'll be a heel, AW seems to be only recruiting heel wrestlers, Ryback might be a babyface, but we really can't tell for sure, Brodus is the exception. Why don't we have more babyface new entries, and who do you think will debut from FCW that will actually be a babyface? Perhaps Seth Rollins. Yeah, it's a good point that that Jason makes about the preponderance of heels being brought up to the main roster. I don't really have a great answer for you. You know, Seth Rollins has to come in as a babyface, one would expect. I think he's been a babyface his entire run down in FCW, although in Ring of Honor, I think he was both. When he was part of Age of the Fall, which was the that faction with Jimmy Jacobs, I think he was a heel, then he became a babyface. But he seems to be more of a babyface kind of guy. I think when we see him, he'll be a face. He works well that way. I have a feeling that Cassius Ohno, Chris Hero, down in FCW, may be a face as well once he gets brought up. Which, actually, I think he works better as a heel. So, I don't know. I mean, not to say he can't work as a babyface. I just have seen Chris Hero work, and he just comes off as a freaking awesome heel. But you could always do a heel turn with him later on if he comes in as a face. But I just don't have a good answer for you. I just think there's, generally speaking, probably more heels. And it's always good to have more heels, I feel, than babyfaces. You want to have, I guess, a pretty even number, but to have more heels than baby faces is not a bad thing, but there seems to be way more heels than baby faces. So you make a good point. His second question here is concerning TV ratings. He wants to know why they're such a big deal. I literally never watch any shows live, including wrestling. DVR is a great thing. Do companies take into account modern technologies such as DVR and TiVo and such when worrying about ratings? He says, I'm a fan of wrestling and I'm going to watch the shows no matter what, even if it's a day or two late. And he says, Salamasar, I still can't believe you don't have a DVR or something like that. I would never get anything watched if I didn't have it. What are your thoughts on the issue? Well, for the record, so you know, I will probably be getting a DVR sometime in the next couple of weeks. I'm looking into it. My cable company has something called DVR and DVR Plus, which is supposedly the same price, which doesn't make any sense to me why DVR Plus would be priced the same way as DVR. Who would get DVR if you offered something called DVR Plus? I got to look into this. I will probably get it. And I'm sure once I have it, I will probably look at it and go, I can't believe I went so long without it. But it looks like I am about to finally jump into the 21st century. I'll let you know. But back to your question. They do take modern technology into account when it comes to ratings. When the ratings are released, they also get a percentage breakdown of, for example, DVR viewership, which last I heard was not terribly high for Monday Night Raw. Most people actually do watch the show live. It's certainly not enough people watching on DVR to make a huge dent in the numbers when they are first released. Obviously, ratings are very important to USA Network in competing against networks like TNT and ESPN in the weekly race, and particularly around sweeps time each year when it comes to advertising buys. And USA is the driving force, from all accounts, behind Raw's move to 3 hours. It was not, from what I understand, WWE's choice to take Raw to 3 hours, at least not right now. That was all USA. And so USA obviously wants that extra hour of Raw. They want, they want the extra people watching during that 8 p.m. hour. I said before that NCIS reruns in the 8 o'clock slot will sometimes do better than Raw, which is true. But more often than not, Raw does do better, and so it was USA's call to have more wrestling on Monday nights, and because that race against TNT and ESPN and networks like that, very important. USA wants to be number one at all costs. So to them, it's very important for that reason. You know, for WWE, they're being paid close to $1 million each week. I think it's like $700,000 per episode of Raw for the rights to air that show. And they are expected to deliver above a certain threshold when it comes to the numbers. And because they make so much money these days in rights fees on TV compared to many years ago, and, you know, with their pay-per-view numbers in decline, it seems to be becoming a TNA situation where the real emphasis is on TV and not so much on pay-per-view. With TNA, if Spike boots them off the network, they're dead. So you kind of understand it. With WWE, if they were to lose TV, it wouldn't be a death knell right away, but it would be if no other major network stepped in to pick them up. And WWE got a rude awakening back in 2005, I want to say it was, when they went back to USA, because when they came to an impasse with Spike TV and Spike called their bluff during negotiations and went public and said, basically, we have cut off negotiations. We wish WWE the best in their future endeavors, but they will not be returning to Spike. WWE was probably like, oh shit, because they lost all of their bargaining leverage at that point. Now they just had to go out and pray that some network was going to pick up Raw. USA stepped in, and thankfully for them, they still got a pretty sweet deal out of it, although they probably would have gotten more money if they would have been able to play Spike against USA. If USA didn't step in, I'm not sure who would have picked up Raw as far as major networks go. I'm sure you could have gotten a Fox Sports Net, which once aired TNA. I'm sure they would love to have Raw. Raw on a Fox Sports Net or a WGN America, which is only available in X number of homes and is not a major cable network, would have been death for WWE. It almost would have been bet. They would have been just like not even having a TV network at all. Because unless an FX or a TBS or a TNT or some network like that would have stepped in, that would have been bad news. Really bad news for WWE. So they got a rude awakening that year. And they don't want to fall out of favor with USA, because if USA drops them, and you know, Spike is all tied up with Bellator and TNA, they've got their promotions that they're locked in with for the next couple of years. WWE would find itself in a very perilous situation if that were to happen. Now, if they launch their new network, the network can always be the backup. God forbid that ever happens. You know, they get booted off USA, which could happen. I mean, who's to say it won't happen? Bonnie Hammer and people in power at the USA Network love Vince McMahon and love WWE and brought them back. But who's to say that Bonnie Hammer is going to be there for another 5-10 years? Look what happened with WCW. I've talked about this before. Jamie Kellner, the executive at Turner, who came in and took a look at the books and hated pro wrestling and said, I don't want wrestling on any of my networks. We're taking WCW programming off of TNT and TBS. That was it. That was death for WCW. All it takes is one person who doesn't like pro wrestling or thinks pro wrestling is a bunch of, you know, toothless hicks and is not the audience they want to cater to, and that's all it takes. So if the network launches, they always have that as a backup. They could always move Raw to the network, but how many people are going to get the network? So when it comes, I'm always fascinated by this TV stuff because there's so many different factors at play that people don't really think about. Things are done for a reason. Again, I don't necessarily think the Raw move to 3 hours is a good one unless they do some of the things that I suggested in my editorial, which as a fan I think would be a really cool thing, but they definitely do take things like DVR and TiVo into account. There are separate ratings breakdowns for that. You can have an episode of Raw that does a 3.2, let's say, and 3 or 4 weeks later it comes out, when you add in the DVR viewership, that 3.2 actually was a 3.3, maybe a 3.4. I don't think it would go higher than that. It's just not a significant percentage of people like yourself who watch Raw on DVR. A lot of people watch it live. I watch it live, but that's just because I don't have a DVR. One last quick question here. This comes from Shaber, who writes in. He remembers a couple of years ago, he thinks it was in 03, Ric Flair had a feud with Carlito. I think it was later than that. I want to say it was 05 that Flair, maybe even 06, that Flair feuded with Carlito for the Intercontinental Championship. Anyway, during the match, there was a spot where Ric Flair hit Carlito with the flying elbow, and the announcers were saying that it was the first time he was able to successfully do that move off the top rope. Now, as I recall, I did not see him successfully do it before that either. My question is that true? Was that the first time Ric Flair was able to do that move? No. No, it wasn't. Actually, right off the top of my head, There was the Greensboro match on Raw in May of 03, where Ric Flair challenged Triple H for the World Heavyweight Championship, and some would say perhaps should have won the title that night. You know, Triple H would have won it right back, but it would have been a real feel-good moment. That was the night that Raw went off the air, and they had that big celebration for Flair, and they put him up on their shoulders and everything like that. I'm pretty sure Flair hit the move in that match. There were actually several matches where Flair hit the move. He usually only hit it when he was a babyface. So you could probably even go back to the days of WCW and find a match here and there where he actually did hit the move. You know, maybe when... I can't remember now if Flair's match with Vader in 93, that great match he had when he came back to WCW and challenged Vader for the championship at Starrcade. He may well have hit the move in that match as well. You would see it when Flair was a babyface, but not when he was a heel. But, yeah, this whole thing where in 2006 or whatever it was, oh my God, it's the first time Ric Flair ever hit that move. No. That's just WWE and their revisionist history, which they're so good at. Speaking of revisionist history, for the people who have asked, I have seen the list that WWE.com put out of greatest talkers, like the top 25 talkers. And number one on the list is Stone Cold Steve Austin. Rowdy Roddy Piper is number two. The Rock is number three. And there's a whole bunch of other people on that list. I don't get upset about these things anymore. I don't understand why everybody is so upset. Even Roddy Piper on Twitter was actually offended by the fact that he was number two. CM Punk said that it's an illegitimate list if Piper is not number one. It's even, and this is what Punk said. Punk actually called it typical revisionist political WWE history. Punk is a guy that says what he feels, and he's right, of course, but it's a subjective thing. Roddy Piper was number two on the list and not number one. Who cares? If Roddy Piper wasn't on the list or was number 15, I'd say then that's completely preposterous. You can make an argument that Austin was better than Piper. I don't think he was. I think Piper probably was the number one or two Mike guy. Some people would say The Rock should be number one on that list. Some people would say CM Punk should be higher up on the list than he is. It's a subjective thing, but here's the thing about these lists. They do this on purpose. They do this on purpose for this very reason, because I'm now talking about it, because everybody on Twitter is talking about it. On Facebook, all the social media. That's what they want. They want people on Twitter and social media to talk about this so they can say, oh, look, it's trending. You know, and look how popular our stories are from our website. So if you don't want that to happen, then don't talk about it. That's the only reason that WWE does these stupid lists, which most of the time are complete horseshit. But I've seen worse from them. This is not even the worst list. This list is not that bad. You can dispute the order of people on the list, absolutely. But I've seen far worse from them. But this is what they want. Don't give them what they want. Come on. So anyway, that's the mailbag for this week. Email me your questions at thesolemonster@gmail.com. I will try to get them on the air if at all possible. I do read everything no matter what, so email me there. Follow me on Twitter, @solemonster. We are now well over 1,400 followers and growing. Always fun times on Twitter, so please follow me on there if you are not following me right now. Friend me on Facebook, facebook.com/thesolemonster. All one word. You have to send me a friend request, and I will approve you. We have a live thread going on Facebook during Raw each and every Monday night. Pay-per-views and all that good stuff. A lot of stirring debate back and forth. And so you'll want to definitely friend me on Facebook to get access to that. And you can subscribe to the show in iTunes. Type in Solemonster Sounds Off. The show will come right up. You can subscribe. And you don't have to do anything. The show will automatically be downloaded to your iTunes, I guess, each time a new show is posted. For those of you who have asked me about SC Scoops Live, I put the first one up on iTunes because Noah had taken the time to edit it. There was a lot of dead air at the beginning, and so he edited it. I put it up on iTunes. I don't believe the second episode from this past Monday has been edited. There's a lot of dead air, like literally the first 20 or 30 minutes because the recording started early. We set an early recording time before we actually went on the air. I don't want to upload that to iTunes just because it's just not been edited properly. But if you want to listen to SC Scoops Live from this past Monday, if you missed it, if you were in another country, another time zone, on the official Blog Talk Radio page that was set up to stream the show, there is a download link. I'm sure somebody on Facebook can throw a link up to it. So the show is there. If you want to download it manually, you know, right-click Save As, or stream it that way. I'm just not putting it up in iTunes right now, so don't ask me about that. So that's going to do it for this week, episode 220. I want to thank each and everybody who listens to the show for tuning in and helping make the show a success. I really appreciate it. I hope everybody here stateside is having a good Memorial Day weekend. And hopefully everybody has the day off on Monday. I do. And I don't get too many days off. Actually, I am going to be on the move this week. I'm actually headed to the Beaver State on business, Portland, Oregon, which actually is one of the most storied cities in wrestling history. You had legendary promoters like Don Owen and Sandy Barr, the father of the late Art Barr. Roddy Piper was a fixture of Portland wrestling for a while before he made it big, as were Playboy Buddy Rose and Jesse Ventura and many others. It's also the state that both WWE and WCW refused to run shows in for over 10 years because of the Oregon State Athletic Commission, which had jurisdiction over all wrestling shows and just so happened to require at that time that all performers submit to a drug test when they performed in the state. Funny how that works. I don't believe the commission oversees this anymore, I don't think, and WWE has since returned to running shows in Portland, so there's your history lesson for the day. That's where I'll be for about a day or two this week. I look forward to that. So, until next week, episode 221 of The Sound Off next week, and I want to thank you again. Be well, stay safe, have a good holiday weekend, and we will see you right back here next week.
Let me tell you something, fella.
This is Joel from Northern Ireland.
Hi, I'm AJ Grimaldo.
And quite simply, the fastest 60 minutes on the internet.
The Solar Monster sounds off on SEScoops.com.